Most importantly, Jim, how's your golf going?
Well, it's very good, apart from the fact that I've got an injury at the moment. I've had a trapped nerve all down here for a long time. I've got a trapped nerve on my leg as well, all golf-related. And it flared up. So I did, and actually, it's been flared up for 2 weeks, so I didn't play this weekend. And then I went to my physio yesterday, and he said, well, you can get back into doing a bit of weights. So I did weights this morning, and it's really bad.
Yeah, I need to watch that. In Warburton, aren't you?
Yeah. And West Hill, actually.
And West Hill. Yeah. I was at West Hill a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah?
It was lovely.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah.
Do your kids play?
They've just started. Well, they've started in the last couple of years, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. It's something I mean, I'm a terrible golfer, but I would like... Yeah. I think it'd be quite a nice thing to do with my son, actually.
Yeah.
How old is he? He's six.
Yeah, my six-year-olds love it.
Have you got twins?
You've got twins. Yeah, twins, six, yeah.
It's a great age. It's
I took him on Warpleston for my golf course for the first time on the weekend. I'll do the old proud dad. So this is one of my 6 year olds.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, it's very good. Wow. He's got a great move at the ball.
Yeah. He's a John Daly. Look how far he goes back.
A big overswing. Look, get that one.
Yeah. Right over.
God, he really does hit it well.
He rips it, doesn't he?
Yeah,
is he in year...
He's year two.
Year two. Okay, so he's a young year two.
Yeah, he's August, but yeah.
Gotcha. So. I was going to say, he looks bigger than my Charlie.
Yeah.
He's April, he's six in April, but he's going to year two in September. My daughter's four, she's going to reception in September, which will be a shock to the system for her. She's 4 years old, she's going to reception starting.
Yeah. We had our first sports day yesterday for our boys in reception. Yeah.
So did you take part?
No, there was no dad's race.
I did the dad's race, and in the dad's race, there were four torn hamstrings. Because, of course, no one warms up.
No, of course.
And they've got their kid there who is never.
Desperate to impress.
Yeah. No one's ever going to try harder than when their kid's watching.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Good. How are we looking, Alex? Good, yeah. Happy, all got cups replenished, etc. Good, well, we'll get cracking then. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 33. Pleased to be joined by Jim Reed. Jim is Managing Director and Global Head of Macro and Thematic Research at Deutsche Bank. He also heads up the Corporate Bank Research and Credit Strategy. He is a consistently ranked top strategist over the last 25 years. His daily early morning read report has been running for 16 years and has tens of thousands of daily readers, and is one of the most widely read financial market pieces in the investment world. Jim joined Deutsche in September 2004 and has 28 years of experience in investment banking. Jim spent the first 3 years of his career in sales and has a BA degree in economics and economic history from Warwick. Is a father, Liverpool FC fan, and a keen golfer. So welcome,
obsessed.
Jim.
Obsessed.
It's good to hear.
Obsessed Liverpool fan. Yeah.
And golfer.
Has your manager been announced yet?
Yes. Arne Slot.
Yeah. Is that exciting?
I have to trust the process of the people that picked him to know that he's the right man for the job, and I vaguely do.
Mm. That'll be good to see.
Looks a bit like you, actually.
To see?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Attractive, good hairstyle, bright blue eyes.
Tall, slim. No comment. Lots going on in the world, Jim, and we've nabbed your chart pack, which might well become the episode title, 50 charts that make you go wow. Well, we don't have 50 charts to go through, but we've sort of broken it up into a few pieces, and we're going to sort of run through a few of these. Obviously, we'll try and explain the charts as best we can for those listening, and just touch on them. But broadly, get your thoughts really. And I thought we'd start with the kind of topic du jour, not elections, but the magnificence of the US equity markets. And we've got a couple of charts here. The market cap of the so-called big three in the States, Apple, Microsoft, Nvidia, all broached $3 trillion. The rise in Nvidia has obviously been nothing short of spectacular / parabolic, whatever you want to call it. And the market cap of Nvidia has now equaled, if not surpassed, the market caps of the UK market, the German market, and indeed the French market, which is having its own issues. It's a sort of pretty big story, isn't it? And kind of come, particularly Nvidia has come out of the AI theme and out of nowhere. I mean, how does this sort of play out from here, do you think, Jim, broadly speaking?
Well, as someone who does macro and mostly advises people on macro, it's a bit of a head scratcher really, because I believe in AI. I mean, I've worked in the business nearly 30 years, and everything in that period is normally pointed to lower productivity. So whether it's debt, demographics, inefficiencies, bailing things out, less creative destruction, most things are pointed to lower productivity. And you know, you do look at AI and you do look at some of the technology and some of the use cases for it going forward, and you genuinely think this could be something that is really what we desperately need, i.e. a productivity booster. But I'll be honest, none of us know the timeline, none of us know exactly how it's going to boost productivity, and none of us know who the winners are going to be. I mean, if you look through history, when there's been productivity gains from new technologies in the past, often the people that lay the pipes and the infrastructure aren't the ultimate beneficiaries of it. You know, you could look at the railway lines in the late...
Yeah, I was about to say the 1840s Great Railway Broom, which is pretty niche content for our viewers and watchers, but it is quite an interesting, you know, lots of investors piled into the expansion of the railways and ultimately got very burned, and not dissimilar with dot-com, right?
Yeah, and the rest of the economy massively benefited from having railway lines through the country that allowed you to get from A to B quicker and produce and goods to get to A to B quicker. But the people that invested in the initial railway lost most of their money, if not all of their money. So this is the kind of, I think, one of the interesting dilemmas at the moment, that I can see something that is genuinely exciting for the first time in some time. But I don't know who the winners are going to be, and the market is making very strong, confident bets at the moment that it knows who the winners are going to be. And I think that's something to be aware of, especially as these stocks, and you know, you could even narrow it down a bit more to Nvidia, are having a huge influence on macro at the moment in a way that I've never seen in my career. I've never seen so few big cap stocks influence financial conditions and kind of macro sentiment as much as that they are today.
And we've got another chart here which just lumps together the Mag 7, Magnificent 7, with a combined value of about 16 trillion, which compares to, you know, another number of other segments of the market, the financials, the energy sector, the healthcare sector, you know, dwarfed by the Mag 7. So I think you're right. You know, that is kind of, they are the story in markets, and they are, probably influencing kind of macro to a degree. And then just sort of as a sort of an aside from that, not only that, we've got a very high concentration of the US market, where the top 10% of stocks by size make up 75%, is that right?
Yeah, and it's probably tipped a bit above that since the chart was updated at the end of April. We've only got May data, and I think it's probably really getting above the record now.
Yeah. I mean, what I guess if you were just kind of pointing this, and we've got, you know, sampling of N equals 3, so let's not we're too much into it, but you know, the last times were 1931 and 1999 where you had such high concentration of the top stocks, and they weren't particularly good times for investors to be pouring money into the equity market, right?
No, they weren't. I suppose the one thing I would say in the defense of the big companies today is that, you know, if I look back at the any of those periods in the past where there's been a market peak of concentration, you probably didn't have a globalized world for a product that literally can be sent through the ether, if that makes sense. Not all of it, but a lot of the products that the big tech firms in the US produce now can be you can export them globally. I mean, something like Microsoft, obviously if you're any country in the world with any kind of commerce, you are likely to have a Microsoft product. And you can buy at a click of a button. So I do think there's an element where there are justifications why this is a period where concentration could be high relative to the past. Doesn't mean to say it's sustainable, but there's probably a little bit more justification today for how you could get there than some of the periods in the past.
Yeah, I mean, we've got Microsoft Office Suite right across the, and we've just started the Copilot trial for some of us. And, you know, genuinely, it is quite, you know, come back to your point about AI, it is some of the stuff it can do is, this is genuinely going to help me and save me some time on a day-to-day basis, which ultimately is great for Microsoft because it means that we bung them an extra $30 a month or whatever the extra subscription cost is, right?
And going back to the macro piece, do you think NVIDIA and the investment that's gone in has potentially staved off the recession that we all thought was definitely coming last year and didn't quite appear. So that kind of massive spend into chips and probably the knock-on of keeping people employed, has that had as big an influence as we think it has?
I actually think that maybe the bigger influence is what it did to financial conditions. So in the US economy, how buoyant the stock market is, how controlled yields are, how available funding is, blah, 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 all goes into kind of a financial condition metrics, and the stock market is a big part of that. And I honestly think there was a wealth effect that came through because of the Magnificent Seven that has probably been a big part of why the US economy staved off a downturn. Now, the bits that you talked about are also very valid as well, but I think we shouldn't underestimate financial conditions and how important that is to an economy like the US.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And then just sort of, you know, widening the net a little bit on in terms of, you know, the US market, semiconductors now as a proportion, or sorry, relative to the S&P is at, you know, pretty much all-time highs. But on sort of more widely, if we look at kind of growth versus value, this is a relative chart of the NASDAQ to the Russell 2000 of the US small cap, again, kind of touching those kind of 2000 highs. And then finally, markets have been kind of eerily calm, haven't they? And we have got the number of consecutive days without 2% down day, so we haven't had any days in the US market where we've had a 2% fall for, what's that, 250 days or something?
I think it's over 300 trading days,
and that's generally you know, points to a kind of a calm market. And is that, I don't know, is that in itself bullish or bearish, or just kind of it is what it is and we're in a calm market environment and it's going up?
I think it probably is what it is, but it tells you that there is no real doubt in the market's mind at the moment that markets are fairly insured.
And we had, I guess the one that brings to mind as it came to an end was 2017, and actually I remember 2017 because the market basically went up every day and we had very little volatility, and everything did well. Tech did well, probably outperformed, but not to the same degree it is now. And of course, in the first quarter of 2018, we had a pretty kind of rough patch, didn't we? So, does this kind of calm market, does that mean that there's stuff bubbling under the surface? You know, a bit like tectonic plates when they get tighter.
Well, I suppose if you wanted to take that argument, you'd look at the graph and see what happened before 2008, where you had the longest stretch without a 2% down day, which was nearly 1,000 days. So I think there is a lot of evidence in all sorts of markets that the longer you have stability, the more risky it is, because people get probably too accustomed to no risk. I mean, if you wanted the extreme view, it's kind of the Minsky moment.
Minsky, a bit more niche content here.
Yeah, so I think corrections and are quite healthy to market, because in the same way that I think recessions and defaults are healthy for markets, because they add a bit of tension, they add a little bit of risk, so that people, when they're making decisions, are aware of the downside. And the longer you're not aware of the downside, the more likely you are to do things that are bad, if that makes sense, in investment terms. So I one of my concerns of the last few decades is that the authorities have constantly tried to reduce downside risk. And I think that creates a lot of inefficiency and bad investment, and it doesn't help productivity in the long run. So I'm someone that firmly believes that markets are healthier if you allow them to fail when they need to fail, if that makes sense.
And sort of allied to that, I think having had 10 to 15 years of money costing zero, I think has led to some of those issues as well. You know, money should cost something. If you want to go and borrow money to invest in a new building or buy some land, you should have to pay to borrow that money, not have rates at zero. And I think that's a very similar kind of feeling in my mind. So yeah, I mean, markets have been quiet. Maybe by the time this goes out, we'll have had something have kicked off. We're recording the day before the UK election. I'm not entirely sure the UK election is going to bring about any kind of significant volatility, but we've also got the French election coming on Sunday, so we'll talk about that a bit later, I'm sure. Moving this sort of conversation on to some kind of really sort of interesting long-term stuff. We touched on AI and how you're super bullish on it, and we've got a chart here of UK productivity and real wages going back to 1209. Yes, I did read that right, nearly 1,000 years ago, so the Deutsche Bank treasure trove must be pretty deep. And that sort of shows that over, you know, most of the medieval ages through to the early Industrial Revolution, real wages were flat and productivity kind of went nowhere. But we've had, well, you go and explain what's happened since, Jim, and how has that worked
out? Well, I suppose the point of this graph is that actually what people forget is before the Industrial Revolution, life for every subsequent, every generation that followed the previous one was pretty much the same. It was mm-hmm. pretty bleak economically. You lived kind of in the moment of surviving, really, and economic conditions didn't get better. And I think this graph is the best graph you can show someone to say that growth is good. Because as soon as we started to go through industrial revolutions and the kind of momentum that created and the ancillary good that brought, you started to see economic growth, you started to see wages go up, you started to see productivity go up, and you started to see health improve. So if you look at, I mean, there's a great study, and I'll get this slightly wrong, but there's been skeletal remains discovered of people over the last 2,000 years, and the average height of a human was pretty much the same from, let's say, year zero to year 1800. And then in the last two centuries, that height has got progressively higher as we've got healthier and
bone structure got better and eating.
I think this graph, you say this is why growth is good.
Totally. And then, you know, to all those kind of doomsayers, and I say this as a farmer's son, so careful what you say, you know, is AI going to take all the jobs?
I look at this as someone that's kind of steeped in economic history. I answer this probably a little bit simplistically, but that's what my DNA is. I'm kind of an economic historian. Mm-hmm. And all through history, you've heard fear stories about new technologies replacing human work and it being cataclysmic for the human race and for society. Mm. And what has tended to happen through history is that when technology has replaced something, it creates something else that we didn't know we needed. So, you know, back at 150, 200 years ago, the vast majority of people worked in agriculture, and it was subsistence farming, really. You worked in agriculture to feed your family, your colleagues, your fellow beings, and most people, you know, it was if not a one-to-one ratio, it was pretty high intensity of agriculture to feeding people. And as the technology increased and less people were needed in agriculture, people thought, well, what are people going to do? This is going to destroy people's livelihood. But the extra wealth that created allowed people to spend on other things, and new industries got created. And this is something that repeats time and time again in history. And probably the best example I can probably give is the auto industry, where in the early 20th century, the auto industry was starting to grow in the US. And then they discovered the ability to automate some of that, and they had a production line. And there was outrage that this was a great American industry that just started employing more and more people, and yet you're now going to take these jobs away via the production line. Mm-hmm. But what happened is, as the production line progressed very quickly, cars got cheaper. As cars got cheaper, they became more of a mass market. Not only did that mean that you can employ more people in the industry, but the ability to have a car and to drive meant that so many opportunities of economic growth opened up, whether that's suburban house building, whether it's tourism.
The gas station, the diner. Yeah, the diner. Comes off the theme park, whatever it might have been. But And AI, potentially, you know, maybe artificial intelligence can do James and I jobs, and we can see him make podcasts all day long. I mean, that's the kind of natural extension, right?
Yeah, look, the counter would be that this is probably the final technology that maybe is completely replacing humans. I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but the argument would be this is replacing the human mind, and therefore there's nothing more we can do. I mean, I don't subscribe to that, but that's the kind of counter argument.
Yeah. And then back to your point on sort of poverty and progress that humans have made. You've got a chart here of the share of the population living in absolute poverty from 1820. And we can see that line goes down, and line goes down means that there are fewer people living in poverty, to the point where barely 10% are under $1.90 a day, and that's inherently good news, right?
Yeah, and I mean, we have to be slightly careful, you know, because there are still people that live in extreme poverty. But I would say that growth has been great for that. And I suppose what this other what this graph also shows is that globalization has been great for this, because a lot of the rapid gains have been made in the last 40 years, where globalization EM has really grown. Now, there is a kind of a counter to that, that the globalization has perhaps maybe reduced living standards in the developing world. For the lower paid, which we're seeing in elections all the time. But in aggregate, growth and globalization has been good for this.
So that kind of rise of populism, and we've seen it, you know, we can go back 10 years when Trump was first elected, UK-European referendum, we've got it in France, we've got, you know, rise of populism and potentially China and the West, you know, diverging, should we say, globalization is not necessarily going to reverse. You could argue it's going to reverse, but it's definitely not going, not progressing as much as it was. Is that a broad threat to some of this thesis?
Well, I do think the risks are that globalisation will, reverse is a big word. I think it probably will reverse, to be honest.
You've got reshoring and the kind of bringing back of jobs to particularly America.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the US, the one thing that there's bipartisan support is to be more hawkish towards China. So given that China was at the epicenter of globalization, you would have to think that we are going to see more of a reverse in globalization, whoever wins the election, really. Obviously, whoever wins will have different ways of showing that, but regardless, I think globalization is probably on the retreat at the moment.
Yeah, we'll have to. That's something we've talked about quite a lot on the board in the last couple of years, isn't it? You know, the potential for that to go into reverse and the world become a bit more splintered. And that sort of leads me quite nicely, actually, onto debt, global debt, and government debt in particular. And we've got a couple of octogenarians fighting it out in the States. We've got a chart here of US debt as a proportion of GDP, including some forecasts from the Congressional Budget Office. I get that right, CBO? Yeah. And not good. So US debt to GDP currently 100%, in line with post-Second World War amounts, and due to get worse. We've got another chart here, I think, of debt interest payments, i.e. how much they spend on servicing their debts. And that line is going up and to the right, so not good either. I mean, is this something that... Well, I've just come out of a meeting, actually, and we were talking about, you know, the potential for a Trump election and what that might mean for the US fiscal position. Should this be a real concern? And if so, what should we potentially be doing about it?
Well, it's interesting that since the debate on Thursday night, where, you know, the perception is that Biden didn't do as well as Trump, the 10-year yields shot up. Because the perception was that Trump is more likely to win the election, and therefore the fiscal side of it comes into view. I suppose if I speak to our economists, they actually think whoever wins the election, deficits are going to be quite similarly big.
Yeah.
So even if Biden wins, although you might not see the same level of tax cuts, it's unlikely you'll see spending fall. And actually, if Trump wins, he may get revenues from the tariffs. So I'm not sure the market interpretation is something that I would 100% agree with.
Okay.
To be honest, I think whoever wins the election, deficits are going to be big. I wouldn't necessarily say one side is going to necessarily massively outspend the other or outstrip the other.
What do you think makes governments tackle the debt pile? Do you think they just keep going until until basically they get caught out?
Look, I think... Democracies are still relatively young in terms of their long-term history. And I think democracies have developed the most rapid at the most rapid pace from an era where government debt was quite low. And I suppose the issue is that we live in an era now where people want governments to spend money on them. And are not that keen on paying the tax to pay for it. So we have this kind of almost revolving kind of door of political views where, you know, one side will say we will spend on this and they will get elected and maybe they don't manage to fulfill their promises. And then the opposite extreme does that. And I think that's increasingly become the issue as people... increasingly want more money spent on them than they're prepared to pay. And therefore, the way to get elected in most countries is to promise
to spend.
To spend. Mm. And therefore, this probably goes on until the market says no. Mm. So I don't think deficits are going to rein themselves in most countries until they need to be.
Because the market sort of said no after 2008, the financial crisis, didn't it? And there were periods of austerity, and the focus, I remember coming out of there, was how do we get the debt paid down? You know, is it increased taxes? And actually productivity was kind of a bit sluggish out of that. And then it seemed to change politically. You know, there's a change in view of we've got to grow out of this, and that's where the spending came in. But as you say, it's the market that almost controls it in terms of how it prices treasuries or gilts, mm. and whether it's prepared to, you know, buy the government's debt or not. So I guess, as you know, the answer is governments keep doing it whilst they can get away with it until people vote for something else.
Yeah, well, we've had our Liz Truss moment in the UK, haven't we? And that was the bond market. Not all Liz Truss's fault. The bond market was in a pretty febrile position when she went ahead with that budget. But, you know, we've seen a sort of almost a shadow of what might happen. And we're seeing it a little bit in French bond markets in the last week or so. We got some charts on France. So the UK is very much in a very different position to the US because it is up against that constraint, because we've just, you know, civil service and politicians in general, including the Labour Party, are pretty terrified of another kind of bond market whoopsie.
Because the Labour Party have said if they get in power, they'll give the OBR the full 10 weeks, haven't they, to analyse all their numbers, and they're petrified of having another, as you say, a trust moment.
Another trust moment. And we've actually got a chart here of the UK budget deficit, which goes back to 1700. So again, well done on ticking out some pretty decent 300-year data. And as we can see, we've got deficits in the last 50 years that, you know, almost kind of look warlike in terms of how big they are.
Yeah, without getting too nerdish on this, the simple interpretation of this chart is that up until the last 50 years, you only ran a deficit really if you were at war. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, the budget balanced. And part of that was because before the last 50 years, virtually every economy, apart from in extreme wars, was tied to gold. So the amount of money you had in circulation had to be tied to gold. Yeah, I won't go through the minutiae, but that's what happened. And then in the early 70s, that the whole world moved away from gold after Nixon suspended the mm-hmm. Bretton Woods system. Mm-hmm. And that at that point, that gave governments an option of spending more than they got in, because you wouldn't have gold leaving the country and it wouldn't undermine your reserves. Your currency would devalue if you were the only person doing it,
everyone's doing it.
So the last 50 years for me has been a story of the world moving from structural balanced budgets, apart from wars, to structural deficits. Now, you could get away with it at the start of that period, because in the 1970s, debt to GDP in most countries was plus or minus 20%. Mm-hmm. So I don't think anybody would think that 20% debt to GDP is unsustainable. Sure. But most countries now, with the exception of a few like Germany, etc., are at least 100% debt to GDP. And I think, you know, when you've got a debt load the exact same as your GDP, you start to at least raise the question of unsustainability. Mm.
Mm. And talking of unsustainability, so topic du jour, France. France's budget deficits over the last 200 years look not dissimilar, if not slightly worse, than the UK's. And what are you sort of telling clients when they're phoning up saying, Jim, what should I be doing with my French oats, as they're named?
Well, I mean, I think most governments in the West have an unsustainable debt profile, but that doesn't mean to say that it's going to be completely a problem in the next 24 months. And obviously, if you look at where French spreads are relative to Germany now, they've widened. Widen out. So yeah,
you've got a chart here. Actually,
you can see the graph here. So actually, the spread now has spiked out to levels where it has been in, if not crisis, in kind of more extreme end of the equation. But you know, at 70 to 80 basis points, it's still very, very low if you look at the long term history. Yeah. So
I don't think we've got the long one. There's yeah. A long
so
chart, isn't there,
which goes at the moment, it's not a big issue, and you know, markets will probably rein in any new government to some degree, and the most likely outcome in the French elections. I don't know when this is going to go out, so maybe
probably after the election, unfortunately. Yes,
yeah, so maybe I shouldn't say what it looks like. Yeah, no comment. You know, if there's a hung parliament, then we might just get a year of kind of no real policy action in France, and maybe the premium of French oats are going to stay elevated. But mm-hmm. this is probably something that bubbles up over 2 to 10 years rather than the next 12-24 months in terms of real unsustainability.
Well, we've had the Italians have been Meloni's been elected in Italy for a fair while now, and they've not. I know Italy and France is not quite the same, and France is a bit bigger and probably feels it's got a bit more firepower, particularly in the EU relative to Italy. Yeah. But looking at Alex over here, our Italian correspondent, and they haven't seemed to have done much to upset the apple cart in Italy, and therefore you could probably paint a similar picture for France, right? Even if Le Pen becomes leader, prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, Meloni is the example of kind of someone that's got power and then kind of reined it in a little bit to kind of cement that power. I mean, ironically, I think Meloni has been helped by the fact that after COVID, there's been a tolerance of higher deficits. So Italy's got a deficit of over 7%.
Okay.
And that if the EU turned round to her and said you have to get below 3%, either she would have to be much more aggressive, or the EU would have to be much more aggressive. Now this is coming because as you've seen, the European Union or Commission do want to get back to kind of some form of the stability pact, and they've put a deficit procedure on they're pending deficit procedure on a number of countries. So this tension will come back. But I think Meloni has managed, I think Meloni's probably managing to keep a good domestic support, because for the first time in probably a couple of decades, Italy is opening the purse strings to some degree. And that's helping her internally. So one of the reasons why Italy politics was perhaps so unstable for 20 or 30 years is that to meet the kind of the stability pact, they had to run a very tight budget, and they had a primary surplus for most of the last 30 years. So when people look at the Italian deficit being quite high before COVID, most of that was interest payments.
Okay.
So the actual amount they spent on their population was less than they taxed their population. So they were one of the rare countries that had a primary surplus just to keep debt manageable. And that is probably a recipe for populism, because you're constantly kind of annoying your voters, effectively.
100%. And this is an interesting chart.
Our Italian correspondent is nodding.
He is busily agreeing. Perhaps that's why he's in London, not in Italy. But we have got election fever. So we've got nearly 50% of the world going to the polls this year, which is the highest share ever.
Ever, yeah.
So we'll be heading out tomorrow to put our crosses in the box, I'm sure. And that comes back to the populism thing. I don't think it tells us a huge amount, but lots to kind of look ahead to. So we've got the US rest of the year. Anything else notable for the rest of the year?
Well, I must admit, I did this chart back end of last year, and I think it's one of those great charts that look good. This is the year where the most people ever is going to go to population. I thought, well, most of those elections will be fairly dull. And then obviously you had the South African, the Indian, Mexican, the European elections, and now the French from nowhere. I think tomorrow's I'm going to be guilty here of saying this before the podcast gets released, but the UK election tomorrow is likely to be relatively dull. The US election is likely to be anything but dull. But
in the UK it's quite strange, because we've actually gone from looking from that Truss moment of complete chaos to actually, if the result tomorrow is as expected, actually it's a pretty stable platform in terms of where we come from. Actually, from looking like the real sick man in Europe, we're actually looking on a much better footprint than we were before. So And actually, that was one of the things in Brexit, was to provide a more stable platform. I mean, it's been anything but since that 2016 vote. But it is quite interesting how quickly it's turned.
Sterling hasn't really perked up, but I think James is right. There's a sort of an environment in the next few weeks where the UK has a stable centre-left government with a big majority and a pretty moderate manifesto, and we've got a little bit of chaos going on in Europe and some chaos in North America. I mean, does that help Sterling, do you think? And does that bring people back to the UK?
Yeah, I mean, it should be priced in to some degree, and that's reflected in it. I mean, look, I think we've had this debate in our research team about whether populism has passed its peak. And my argument has always been that until we get economic growth that is of the right level, we are probably just going to move from one end of populism to the other, mm-hmm. and there'll be periods in between where one country is stable and another country pokes its head up above the populism parapet. And at the moment, the UK is definitely retreating.
Yeah.
In the centre, obviously, we've got the Reform Party who are polling very well, but the UK is a relative stability on that front at the moment. You know, if this current government that is likely to get in tomorrow, who, you know, haven't really outlined any different policies to the current administration, if in 5 years' time the voters are equally frustrated at them, then, you know, there's no reason why you wouldn't get a more populist in the UK.
I mean, it's just been every time, it feels like recently we've had a vote on something, it's just been a vote for change, as you say. Yeah. It's one extreme to the other. We don't feel, you know, we're not happy with the way it's been, so let's vote for the other side, or, you know, Brexit, classic vote. You know, there was a result that no one really expected. As you say, you know, the answer is in economic growth. It's until people feel happier and better off. But it's strange because, you know, the deficits of governments are there because it's propped up the private sector in a way, but there's been a transfer of wealth, essentially. There's been big corporates that have benefited over the years of this excess spend and this liquidity that's been pumped in, you know, quantitative easing. But as we know, the wealthy have got wealthier, and it's the biggest disparity between poor and wealthy that there has been. And I think that is, in my mind, the sole reason why you are having these extreme votes. It's tricky.
Yeah, but it also has a global influence because, obviously, as I say, the globalisation has reduced the value of lower paid work and exported it abroad, and therefore that's been a problem that has contributed to populism as well.
Mm. Yeah, of course, yeah.
And then part of the sort of populism issue, particularly in the UK, has been kind of immigration. And you've got some great charts here on population, which we'll run through. So, you know, firstly, the US, net migration into the US, this chart goes back 25 years, is currently running at 3.5 million people, pretty much a year, which is pretty much double what it was pre-pandemic. And you've made a note that this has kind of helped with inflation. I mean, do you want to sort of talk through how that might have been the case?
Yeah, obviously one of the big problems post-COVID was a big labour shortage, and that bid up the price of labour, especially at the low end, which was driving inflation. And some of that has been eased by a massive amount of inward migration, not all of it legal, some of it illegal. And that has definitely helped increase the labour supply and taken the pressure off inflation and helped the Fed, etc. And, you know, our estimates suggest that might be worth up to 0.5 percentage point on inflation, which doesn't sound a lot, but when you're trying to get to 2% or get close to 2%, you know, being at 3.5 or being at 3, for example, is a reasonably
not immaterial.
Yeah, it might be the difference between one or two more rate hikes, or even two or three more rate hikes. So that I think has helped. The irony is that the Republican Party will probably use the high levels of immigration as a weapon in the election campaigning, and I'm not sure the Democrats will necessarily take credit for the effect of the migration on things like inflation. So it's a fascinating political kind of hot potato.
And it's more so in the States. So the data you've got, the similar data for the UK, albeit we've got migration as a percentage of population. This goes back to 1850 again, so Royal Treasure Trove. This shows actually throughout the kind of 1800s and most of the 20th century, immigration was actually negative. So sorry, net migration was negative, i.e. more people emigrated from the UK than came in. And that all changed in the kind of mid to late 90s, I guess. And then we had the accession of the Eastern European countries into the EU in the early noughties, when that number kind of spikes up. And then we had Brexit, and the number went from, you know, doubled if not tripled. So we now have effectively 1% of the population net coming to the UK. So the UK population is 70 million, that's 700,000 people a year coming to the UK. So how is it, I mean, how is it that we took, so-called took back control, yet immigration has pretty much doubled since?
Yeah, loaded question, but. And it's been a very different type of migration. So the EU numbers have fallen aggressively, and the non-EU migration has picked up aggressively. So migration has not changed, or has got a bigger issue after Brexit. Mm. I suppose the problem with this chart is that a lot of the inward migration actually is not necessarily skill matched to where we have gaps in the labour force. So I'm not sure that the UK migration story has the same inflation dampener.
No, a lot of it's students as well, isn't it, post-COVID?
Yeah, students. Yeah, and maybe a little bit higher skilled migration, which sounds good, but integrating it into economy on day one or day two is more difficult than maybe in the US, where there's been a lot of low skilled migration, which the economy actually needed. At the time. So look, from a long-term point of view, you might say that having a higher skill migration is actually a good thing. It's not necessarily easy to integrate that immediately.
Mm. Yeah, no, agreed. Well, certainly from a sort of anecdotal perspective, in the last few years, we've taken a number of people from outside the EU onto the farm just because we haven't been able to get people locally. And actually, it's been quite costly, actually. It's not been cheap, but it has been, you know, pretty large numbers, and that's the same across.
You are the Clarkson of the...
The Clarkson of West Wales, yeah, something like that. Something I never thought I'd say. And then some on that sort of immigration theme, really. I mean, these charts were pretty staggering as well. So we've got a number of charts here on births versus deaths for a number of countries. Firstly, we've got Germany, and we can see that there are significantly more deaths than there are births in Germany. Let's think back to my A-level GCSE geography kind of bathtub model of immigration. You've got births, deaths, and immigration and emigration. So from a sort of births and deaths perspective, Germany, not very good. And then we've got another chart here with Japan, UK, France, and US. You know, fair to say that Japan is also running at a higher death rate than birth rate. UK and France, roughly in line with each other, albeit the France one, you know, the number of births in France is declining pretty rapidly, and it's only the US where they're actually having more births than deaths. I mean, what is this sort of, is this something genuinely to worry about for the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, I think it's just a huge debate that we need to have with our populations and our economists to know what the right thing to do is. I mean, the problem is that if you want outright economic growth and you have more deaths than births, it's going to be very difficult, because there's two ways you can grow your economy. You either have more people in the labour force or you have higher productivity.
Yep.
And therefore, if you've got a situation where the labour force is going to decline because of this, then your only lever is productivity. Now, there is a counter argument that says that you should look at GDP per capita. Japan actually has done pretty well on GDP per capita, even though it's depopulated. But I would then come back to the problem with that is if you've got a high debt burden, you kind of need more people to service it. So there's a few different threads here. I think most economists would always default into migration is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But economists and politicians have not sold that story very well to populations who are naturally increasingly building up a kind of a momentum to not support migration.
Yeah. No, and on the point about sort of this moves on to the population, working age population. The first chart here is France, Germany, and Italy, in classic Western European countries. And from today, this is projections going out the next 50, 80 years. You know, the proportion of working age population is falling quite meaningfully in Italy, actually, but also to France and Germany. And then we've got the same data for Asia, so for China, South Korea, and Japan, which, you know, again, down to the right from here. So they've got fewer workers to make the stuff, to produce the GDP, to service the people who aren't working, namely the elderly and the children to a degree. And again, that's you're right, that's something that we need to have a conversation about.
This leads perfectly into AI, doesn't it?
Well, that does come back to where we started, isn't it, on the productivity AI thing. You know, if we can do more in terms of productivity, what does that mean? Us being able to do more, create more per hour of work or per day's work per person, and if AI helps in that, then is that potentially a solution, or is that a little bit wishful thinking on my part?
It is. I would say that most of the productivity miracles in the past have also come along with population big increases. So I suppose the risk is that even if AI is productivity enhancing, if the population decline or working age population declines fairly rapidly, it's not going to be in aggregate brilliant. It might just offset some of the decline. So, you know, you might need to combine your kind of policies. You might need to make sure AI is successful, but you also might need to ensure that the working age population doesn't decline like these predictions suggest. And, you know, that might mean making people work longer. It might be a voluntary thing. I mean, all of us in this room might be forced to work beyond normal working age population.
It's part of the reason that the French are kicking off, isn't it? Because they're making the work past, 62 or 58? I don't know what it is, but it's...
it's tension, a big issue, right? In the French election. Yeah. Mm. And most of the politicians are now moving back towards a lower retirement age.
Mm. Which is probably not sustainable in the medium to long term, but that's...
It's a nice vote winner, though. Because this is the problem going back to the Greek... kind of debt crisis, wasn't it? That their retirement age. Do you remember there was massive
52 or something? Wasn't
it? It was very young.
But then I guess, you know, when you talk about some of these big issues like productivity, depopulation, immigration, you know, these are decisions that need to be made with people who've got longer than 5-year time horizons. And your politician's got a 5-year time horizon because he needs to get re-elected. So I sort of think there's a, you know, what's the posh word for it, intertemporal disequilibrium there in terms of making long-term decisions. And it took, you know, if I think about the UK, 1945, there were some pretty major social changes. You know, the NHS came along, etc. They were multi-generational decisions that were made by politicians at the time. Do we ever get back to that, or are we just on this kind of 5-year electoral cycle roll?
Unfortunately, I think that we're at a starting point where it's very difficult for the right decisions to be made by any politician, and that's not a criticism. If I was a politician that was trying to make sure I got re-elected I would have to think differently from what is, as an economist, what is the right thing to do here. You know, you have to be careful criticising politicians too much, because their job is to try to keep their job in as much as it is to anything else.
Well, that somewhat cheery note, I think we'll leave it there. But I mean, I don't know about you, Heasy, but there's a few charts there that have made me kind of go, wow. So, well done, Jim. You've nailed that. Definitely.
That's been fascinating.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for coming in today. And we'll hopefully see you next time.
Pleasure. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Any questions, get in touch. James.Hughes@quarterchevia.com or I'm Jonathan.Raymond@quarterchevia.com. And we'll see you next time. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.